The CBS News Weekend Roundup after this short break.
Hello, I'd like to deposit this to checking.
Fate is a fickle master.
What?
The future is uncertain.
Okay, and what's my account balance?
Ah, the horizon is cloudy. I see a long, treacherous voyage filled with great peril.
Look, can I just get a deposit slip or something?
A fortune bank teller. Surprising. What's not surprising? How much you could save by switching to GEICO.
I see a yellow-eyed serpent.
What?
And a low APR.
GEICO. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more.
This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup. It was back to school this week for the students at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School.
When do you think things will go back to normal for you?
What's normal? I don't know what that is anymore.
Miss a little, miss a lot. A wild week at the White House over trade, staff, and guns.
You have to look at the age of 21 for certain types of weapons. Take the guns first, go through due process second.
And later.
And that's when I stood up on a chair in the newsroom and I said, something really big is going on.
The 25th anniversary of the first World Trade Center bombing in New York. I'm Bill Rakoff in the CBS News Washington Bureau. Students returned to Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida this week, 2 weeks after the deadly shooting there that claimed 17 lives. About 95% of the students returned to school, welcomed by staff, teachers, and dozens of police officers who lined the sidewalk in support. CBS News correspondent Adriana Diaz has been following the Stoneman Douglas story since the shooting and has more on the return to the classroom.
The school day started with the Pledge of Allegiance, then a 17-second moment of silence honoring the victims. One student told us that the principal went over the PA system and said, "We are Eagle Strong. Today, we reclaim the nest."
Stoneman Douglas students walked out of the red gates just before noon Wednesday, marking the end of a difficult first day back. Hours earlier, 15-year-old freshman Isabella Vanderlatt,
a lot of people are saying we should leave earlier,
and her parents prepared for the emotional day ahead and made the 5-minute drive to school.
When do you think things will go back to normal for you?
What's normal? I don't know what that is anymore.
The armed police officers reminded Isabella of that day 2 weeks ago.
This is what it looked like as soon as I left the building.
While some students gave officers high fives, others felt uneasy by the tightened security.
Everywhere you look is a police officer or like a service dog, and it's just uncomfortable.
Welcome back.
To help comfort students, 150 counselors and more than 40 therapy dogs were on hand. We followed Isabella's mother.
Hi, sweetie.
As she picked her up from school.
It was good we laughed again.
Her classmate, Martin Duke, died in the shooting.
The teacher moved around the desks, but still seeing his empty desk really, really hurt.
I'm emotional every second of the day.
Andrew Pollock, who lost his daughter, Meadow, was also at the school Wednesday. He says the student's return offered relief.
She knew how to get what she wanted. She was a very powerful, strong woman. No one should go through this, what I got to go through. But that's what empowers me to try and fix this. We need to make it so when the kid goes to school, they're safe.
You're a man on a mission.
That's what happens when they murder your kid. There's nothing that could stop me right now.
The superintendent said that 15 students and 4 teachers have asked about transferring. The school returns to a full day schedule next week. Teachers told us they're not worried about academics. They're letting students talk and play games to help them heal.
That's CBS's Adriana Diaz reporting. A group of Stoneman Douglas High School students is at the center of a teen-led revolution. We want to take you inside the making of a movement for safer schools. CBS News began to follow students David Hogg, Emma Gonzalez, Cameron Caskey, and Delaney Tarr from one of their first meetings to behind closed doors with lawmakers. They are organizing this month's March for Our Lives in Washington and ultimately want lawmakers to pass meaningful reforms for school safety and gun laws.
Good morning on this Wednesday.
Your roller coaster of emotions as teachers and staff welcome students.
Class back in session at Stoneman Douglas.
I need to talk to you. What about bulletproof glass? All the glass that's being replaced isn't bulletproof.
We heard more gunshots, and that was when we realized this was not a drill.
In case I died, I wanted to die doing what I love most, which is informing people and telling stories.
If all our government and president can do is send thoughts and prayers that it's time for victims to be the change that we need to seek.
We didn't start the rally, but there were people joining us, saw that we were sitting there, and just started showing up. Then all of a sudden, it turned into a rally, and that was cool.
We are going to be the last mass shooting.
The reason this is going to be the last one is because this is the first real time that we're making a political difference.
We are bringing it right to them.
My advice to you is stay on message and keep following your passion.
Let's start this march.
Woo! We're not trying to take away the guns of people who are hunting, and that's something that we definitely need to clarify.
Any White House contacts, I've been calling like every number I could find, and all of them don't answer.
Why don't you want me to call them now?
Yes, let's
do it.
One call has been forwarded.
The big story tonight continues to be the inspiring activism of children.
Senator Rubio, can you tell me right now that you will not accept a single donation from the NRA in the future?
You guys are being watched by the entire nation.
Well, I don't have a good angle.
You guys need to make sure that you stay strong and you keep the message.
Not one more!
This is your movement and your time.
We support you guys.
To see us listed as these heroes, as these bastions of change, it's scary.
But CNN.
Because we are teenagers, we are children, we are not here to be patted on the back. We're doing it so that our lawmakers will make a change.
Florida lawmakers struck down a motion to consider a bill proposing a ban on assault rifles.
Those people should know that they need to enjoy their political position of power right now, because they aren't going to have it for much longer.
There's no reason we have to have this many guns.
As for what we have in the future, we have the March for Our Lives, March 24th, which is going to be amazing. All the parents are going to be bringing their kids. All the kids are going to be bringing their parents. As much as we'd like to expect that generation to help us out, we've kind of been doing this ourselves, and we've kind of been, you know, winning.
Our thanks to Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School students David Hogg, Emma Gonzalez, Cameron Caskey, and Delaney Tarr for allowing CBS News the intimate access. The four students are now juggling their civic activism with homework as they've returned to classes in Parkland, Florida. We will continue to follow these students on their mission, and you can see more of the behind-the-scenes moments at CBSNews.com. Still to come, a fast-paced, some say chaotic week at the White House.
President Trump's position on gun control has been evolving and evolving in public, leaning in toward gun restrictions earlier this week and then something of an intervention as top officials of the National Rifle Association met here at the White House with the president. Subsequent tweets then indicated both sides were back on the same page.
Also coming up on the program, remembering the Reverend Billy Graham.
The Reverend Graham is celebrating in heaven with Jesus. So I'm here because of the impact that the man has made on our country.
These stories and a whole lot more, including an explanation as to why gas prices might be going up for you this spring and into the summer driving season. Thanks for coming along. This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup. This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup. I'm Bill Rakoff. It has been a wild week at the White House with open meetings on school safety, gun legislation, a surprise announcement on steel tariffs, and a bit of palace intrigue with the departure of a trusted aide to President Trump and his chief of staff joking about being punished in his job. CBS's Major Garrett is at the White House on the week that was for the administration, starting with the back and forth on guns.
President Trump's position on gun control has been evolving and evolving in public, leaning in toward gun restrictions earlier this week and then something of an intervention as top officials of the National Rifle Association met here at the White House with the president. Subsequent tweets then indicated both sides were back on the same page.
President Trump gave gun control advocates hope when he said this on Wednesday.
You have to look at the age of 21 for certain types of weapons. Take the guns first, go through due process second.
But the NRA said Mr. Trump wanted the opposite. Following an Oval Office meeting, NRA executive lobbyist Chris Cox tweeted that Mr. Trump and Vice President Pence, quote, support strong due process and don't want gun control. An hour later, Mr. Trump tweeted that the meeting went great.
It destroys our companies and our jobs.
Mr. Trump also made a surprise announcement detailing new tariffs on steel and aluminum imports.
You will have protection for the first time in a long while, and you're going to regrow your industries.
The tariffs, 25% on steel and 10% on aluminum, prompted fears of a costly trade showdown with China and other U.S. trading partners. That sent the Dow plunging more than 400 points. Republicans slammed the move. Nebraska's Ben Sass said, quote, "You'd expect a policy this bad from a leftist administration, not a supposedly Republican one." Senate Finance Committee Chairman Orrin Hatch, a top GOP voice on trade, called it a blunder.
Whoever advised him on this is ought to be reprimanded.
President Trump's advisors have been the subject of scrutiny this week. Presidential confidant Hope Hicks announced her resignation, and senior advisor Jared Kushner's business dealings are raising concerns about potential conflicts of interest. During a nostalgic visit to the Department of Homeland Security, Chief of Staff John Kelly, the man in charge of keeping the White House in line, jokingly suggested he was cursed.
I did something wrong and God punished me, I guess.
Sources tell us that comment infuriated the president, and there is also word from our sources that the National Security Advisor, H.R. McMaster, long the subject of rumors of his ouster, may in fact now be in real jeopardy. Though through a spokesperson, the president called reports of McMaster's imminent departure fake news.
We're here in the Face the Nation studio here at the CBS News Washington Bureau and with the new moderator and, of course, State Department expert and also on the White House beat. You're doing it all, Margaret Brennan. How's it going so far?
Well, it's going very quickly. I need to dig in and focus full time on Face the Nation. I'm so excited to be able to start doing that because it is just a whirlwind of a news cycle. Even this 1 week alone, it's hard to believe that Monday was just a few days ago rather than a few months ago, given all the different stories, threads that we're going to be chasing and trying to weave together into this Sunday show.
Yeah, we always joke upstairs. We say, if you don't like the story that we're leading with now, wait 24 minutes in this administration and it'll change. But that really bore itself out this week.
It very much did because, you know, the conversation had been primarily around gun policy, gun safety, school safety, that had been the president's message that he really wanted to get something done. He did this two-week listening session. Yesterday, we expected, after he met again with some of the families of victims privately, that he would come out and say officially what he'd decided after 2 weeks of listening. Instead, that didn't happen, and we got a major trade announcement that caught many of the people inside the White House by surprise. I was there in the cabinet room when the president made the announcement. He was very clear and very definitive, and right now you are seeing White House officials kind of scramble because they weren't prepared for him to say what he did in terms of these steel and aluminum import tariffs.
And neither were the markets, taking a 500-point plunge at one point, and now we're hearing that in Europe there's already talk of retaliation, with the EU thinking about some tariffs on some American products. So that beat goes on. On the subject of guns, as you mentioned, we were supposed to hear something about listening sessions. We haven't really heard that yet. What we did hear from the president, though, in a rather extraordinary open meeting with lawmakers, was that he might be willing to give some ground on conservative positions on gun control. But then again, as Major Garrett reported last night, maybe not so much.
Well, that's the thing. The president prides himself on being flexible, but this is a step beyond flexible. It's fungible. And this is the thing. When you deal with Republican lawmakers, they say not only do they not have the appetite, they don't really know what it is that the president is asking them to do, because they're asking, hey, if you want us to act, you need to give us some political cover to do so in a way that allows us the strength to buck the other forces like the NRA and those positions. So one of the Republican lawmakers we're going to have on the show is Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, always an interesting guest. He's been out there saying he doesn't want to see gun restrictions, but he does want to see more on school safety. So we'll talk to him about those ideas and also what he just came back from the Middle East with idea-wise. He's spent some time in Israel and Egypt and the region, and he's very concerned, he says, about what is happening with the spillover from the war in Syria.
And I want to talk a little bit about the palace intrigue this week, too. Hope Hicks on her way out. Lots of rumblings about H.R. McMaster and even the chief of staff getting a little hot water with the boss.
Well, the National Security Advisor, H.R. McMaster, has been rumored to be exiting as soon as he entered this White House. So those stories are not new. But as my colleague Major Garrett had been reporting, perhaps he does have something more to worry about this time. But as for the departures that are official and are happening, we know Hope Hicks, the communications director, another one of the communications professionals who was very close to Jared Kushner, another individual close to Jared Kushner, all of these together appear to be signaling that many of those with deep ties to the family are saying it's time for them to leave the White House.
You mentioned Senator Graham on the show this week. What else can we expect?
Well, we have not forgotten about gun policy and that debate. Joe Manchin, a Democrat from West Virginia, a state that has shown a lot of support for President Trump, has been asked by the president to move forward with this bill he co-authored that will tighten what he calls the loopholes in the background check process. But whether he can get the kind of support needed when the president seems to be wavering in some of those positions is a broader question, because he needs to get more Republican support to get this through, too.
So you're going to watch Face the Nation this Sunday on all of your CBS affiliates, also online at cbsnews.com. Moderator Margaret Brennan, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for making time.
Still to come on the program, it's not your imagination. Gas prices have been going up, and a new AAA study says they will likely go higher in the coming months.
The national gas price average will hit as much as $2.70 a gallon this spring. That is the highest we've seen since the summer of 2015, when it was hovering around 281.
Will that change your driving habits this spring and summer? We'll have a talk with CBS News transportation correspondent Chris Van Cleve. It's next. This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
The CBS News Weekend Roundup after this short break.
Don't have time to keep up with the news? Try the CBS News Radio app on your iOS or Android device. You'll get the latest news as soon as you start it up. It's that easy. You can also listen to great programming like Face the Nation, Weekend Roundup, or the CBS Evening News.
And good evening. Wall Street today signaled its approval of the tax cuts passed by the Republican-controlled Congress.
You can even download them straight to your phone and listen later. It's all on the CBS News Radio app for iOS or Android. Download it today.
This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup. I'm Bill Rakoff. Russian disinformation was the topic of a speech on Thursday for the Carnegie Endowment for Peace in Washington, delivered by the ranking Democrat on the Senate Intelligence Committee, Mark Warner of Virginia. In that speech, Warner detailed what we know about Russian attempts to use social media platforms like Facebook and Twitter to spread so-called fake news.
The rise of these new platforms, like Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, have reshaped our entire culture and the ways we communicate and access information. But while we've marveled at the new opportunities offered by this technology, I believe our government and the technology companies themselves have not fully understood the ramifications of these giant new communities that they've created.
Warner says it's hard to track real-time what the Russians have been doing to meddle in U.S. affairs.
Tracking the impact of the Russian disinformation is obviously inherently difficult. But if we look back to 2011, there was a Russian operations manual that suggested that disinformation, quote, acts like an invisible radiation, silently and covertly pushing you in the direction the Kremlin wants. Truth is, for most, you don't even know you're being attacked.
Warner says the Russians have been very successful in co-opting unwitting Americans into spreading their content.
That's how Russia was able to target and co-opt unwitting Americans into spreading their content outline. They even succeeded in transferring these efforts. This is one of the things that was most described in some of our hearings, from Facebook into the real world. The example we like to cite was back in the fall of 2016, where two Russian-created sites, both created out of St. Petersburg, one that catered to a more far-right group in Texas called Succeed Texas, the other which catered to a group that was about a series of the Muslim community within Texas. And from a half a world away, they created an event where these two groups came into near conflict at a mosque in Houston. Think about that. The ability to manipulate Americans onto the street, and thank goodness for the police presence, or we could have had an event similar to the tragedy that took place in my state in Charlottesville, all this being manipulated and driven from half a world away.
Senator Warner says there are no easy answers to the Russian interference, but he says there ought to be an increased focus on cyber as part of overall U.S. and defense and intelligence spending. He says the Russians are still actively meddling in U.S. affairs.
Russia spends, I think the last year's budget, national level defense-wise, was about $68 billion. The United States of America spends 10 times that much. Yet, I believe we're spending oftentimes on weapons that were well-suited for a 20th century conflict. We buy arms and materials to fight war on the land, in the air, and on the sea. I do not believe that we shifted near enough resources to take on where oftentimes the 21st century conflicts will take place, in cyberspace or in terms of misinformation and disinformation.
Warner says the U.S. needs to make clear to Russia and others that if they use disinformation against us, in his words, we will punch back.
I'm a buddy Jim Bass. He's a working pump of gas, and he makes $2.50 for an hour.
Now we turn to a new report by the American Automobile Association, AAA, that shows that gas prices in the United States are climbing and could climb even higher into the spring and summer driving seasons. CBS News transportation correspondent Chris Van Cleve is here. Chris, this is not news that consumers are necessarily going to want to hear.
Yeah, AAA points out that drivers are paying a quarter more than they were at the same time last year. And while there's been a little bit of a dip in the last couple of weeks, AAA believes that the national gas price average will hit as much as $2.70 a gallon this spring. That is the highest we've seen since the summer of 2015, when it was hovering around $2.81. Now, it's still far better than those days where we were seeing $3 and $4 a gallon gas, but this is more than what people are used to spending. Could be as much as a 40-cent spike for people, and that is going to be noticeable.
So, Chris, according to AAA, is this just a trend, or is this the beginning of a longer climb?
Well, you know, the market is extremely volatile right now with where the oil and the gas price market is. You've seen crude oil prices move up compared to previous years, and domestic demand for gasoline is also up. More people are driving, and people are driving longer distances. So on one hand, gas prices are up. Demand is up. It's not so much a supply issue. It's just the commodity price has creeped up. What AAA found in a survey is that the vast majority of drivers would look at making some changes to their driving habits to offset the higher gas prices.
CBS News transportation correspondent Chris Van Cleve is with us. Chris, will this climb in gas prices, at least according to AAA, lead to a change in driving habits?
It really, particularly when you get to that $3 a gallon line, that's where they found 40% of consumers put $3 as their tipping point. So if we stay under $3 a gallon, most people, at least told AAA, they're going to keep on doing what they're doing. But when you start to get to that $3 mark, that sort of is just a line in people's heads that, wow, gas has gotten expensive again.
And as you point out, that line has moved over the years, because that line, I can remember, it wasn't all that long ago that we had this kind of same conversation over $4, as you mentioned, gasoline. So Americans' attitudes towards this have shifted.
Absolutely. As a Californian, I remember $4 plus gallons of gas. AAA doesn't think we're going to see something like that. We're not going back to that period where gas prices just went up and up and up. But we are going to see an increase that is coming during the summer driving season. We've seen spikes during the summer. It's not uncommon, but you're going to notice this one.
Our thanks to CBS's Chris Van Cleve. There's a new investigation that shows that more people are dying by opting for treatment at surgery centers.
Across the U.S., there are now more surgery centers than there are hospitals, where simpler surgeries are performed. You're in, you're out, but with sometimes tragic results. A USA Today story is gripping. Routine procedures turning deadly, like Joan Rivers. Bill Prentice, head of a surgery center association.
If you looked at the number of adverse events that happen in hospitals compared to surgery centers, you'd see that we're in actually a very safe site of service.
The report says more than 260 people have died at surgery centers since 2013. Jim Taylor, CBS News.
Coming up on the Weekend Roundup.
The hole was 100 feet wide. It was just unbelievable to look at.
Remembering the first terrorist attack on the World Trade Center in New York City. It happened 25 years ago this week, February 26, 1993. We'll talk with a reporter who was there and who is celebrating a milestone himself this week. That's next. Follow us on Twitter. We've got headlines for you at CBS News Radio anytime. And I'm tweeting at Bill Rakoff. This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup. This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup. I'm Bill Rakoff. Before the 2001 attack on the World Trade Center in New York, there was the February 26, 1993 truck bombing of the facility.
We have this just in. We've got reports coming in now to us here at WCBS, reports of an explosion of some sort at the World Trade Center.
The ceiling came in, the glass came in, lockers fell, desks blew.
People who are trapped in the Trade Center have been breaking windows on high floors, sending glass shattering down to the street.
We started smelling smoke. We tried to cover up the doors, but smoke kept coming in anyway.
Smoke was getting pretty thick in there, but everybody's face was pretty much covered with soot, and there were a lot of pregnant women coming down.
Six people died, and many more were injured in the attack, which had been planned by a group of terrorists and introduced Americans to the idea that such violence was capable of being carried out in this country. WCBS reporter Rich Lamb, who is celebrating, by the way, 40 years with our affiliate this week, covered the story that day. Rich, thanks for your time. Walk us through your experience as the story unfolded.
So I was in the WCBS newsroom when word came in that possibly a transformer had exploded in a subway run by the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey between New Jersey and Lower Manhattan, and that it was quite an explosion. And I tried to call the Port Authority, which ran the World Trade Center then, and they have probably 40 people in that office. It was a huge office, and I kept calling, and there was no answer. And that's when I stood up on a chair in the newsroom, and I said, something really big is going on. And then we began to hear on the police radio the kind of response that was going, tremendous number of fire trucks and, of course, police cars headed for the World Trade Center. And it began to become clear that this just was not a transformer explosion.
So, Rich, when did you get the idea specifically that this was something more than a utility explosion, you know, the kind that New York City sees every so often like other cities? I mean, the idea of it being a terrorist attack didn't seem to be high on anybody's list at the start.
It was probably the last thing that we thought was going on. You know, it just seemed like another one of those electrical problems. Who knew? Maybe salt went into a manhole and caused an electrical problem. But no, I mean, the response began to tell us that something else was going on. People were pouring out of the World Trade Center. You know, 50,000 people were working in those towers. So it's just remarkable the number of people who got out. I mean, there were, we found out later, six people were killed by the blast, 1,041 injured. But it could have been an awful lot worse.
WCBS's Rich Lamb is with us. We are talking about the 1993 bombing at the World Trade Center in New York that killed six people. Rich, when did you begin to figure that this was something more, something that was actually a criminal act, in fact, an act of terrorism, something that happened in your backyard?
Well, you know, we all have sources, FBI, NYPD, and it began, they're saying it smells like an explosive. You know, you have friends who are saying, nah, this is not a transformer. There's a huge amount of damage down there. It's got to have been a bomb. And that's when we began to, the hair goes up on the back of your neck when you start hearing that, and you think, what could that possibly, that's crazy. Well, it was a truck bomb. That bomb was huge. It's been variously estimated at like 1,200 to 1,300 pounds. It was mostly urea nitrate, which is basically a fertilizer bomb. This type of bomb was really invented, we're told, in Afghanistan. So, you know, that's where the idea came from. But there were, you know, specialized chemicals for a charge. And then we later learned that there were like three tanks of bottled hydrogen to fuel the fireball. So this was a highly engineered bomb. They mixed it over in Jersey City and drove through the Holland Tunnel and parked in that underground garage beneath the World Trade Center and lit four 20-foot long fuses. I mean, this thing was a masterpiece, if you will, quote unquote, of planning. And they jumped into a getaway car and the bomb exploded, I think, about 12 minutes later, if I remember.
Rich, you mentioned the crater caused by the blast of the truck bomb. What was it like to see that?
You know, it was just about beyond words because, I'd known about what happened down there, and they brought me in. We're talking about maybe a week later. Well, this bomb went off, and it had a tremendous impact. The floors were made of 18-inch thick steel-reinforced concrete. It blew through five levels of that flooring. The hole itself, you know, you had the reinforcing bars were bent upward and downward all over the place. You could smell the cordite. The hole was 100 feet wide. It was just unbelievable to look at. And I guess the reason that it took them a week to get us down there, and I went down actually alone with accompanied only by the head of the Port Authority Public Relations, a guy named Mark Marchese, who is a terrific guy. They wanted to make sure that the structure was stable. And it was, you could smell that, the explosives in the air, and you felt, you know, just looking at this, you had a sense of the power of the bomb, which is just spectacular.
Again, we're joined by longtime WCBS reporter Rich Lamb, who reported the first bombing of the World Trade Center this week in 1993. I remember watching the coverage from home that day and naively making the comment that as bad as the bombing was, there was, in my mind anyway, no way they were ever going to take down the towers. I regret that, but lots of people felt that way, didn't they?
Absolutely. And, just to roll back a little bit, the intent, apparently, of the terrorists was to place this bomb in such a position that it would take out, you know, knock off the pins, if you will, of the North Tower. This is a 110-story tower, an acre footprint. And they were hoping it would tip over and smash into the South Tower, and both towers would come down. That was the plan. Luckily, they did not place this bomb in the position where that worked. And for years after, I can just remember, and I guess this was egoism, I remember driving up the New Jersey Turnpike on the extension there behind the Statue of Liberty, glance at the Statue of Liberty, glance over at the World Trade Center towers, and mumble to myself, those idiots thought they could bring the towers down. It was, you know, you think back on it and you think to yourself, how naive we were.
That's WCBS reporter Rich Lamb in New York, who covered the first World Trade Center bombing in 1993 and again is celebrating 40 years with the station. Our congratulations. Still to come, we were duped.
That's how Russia was able to target and co-opt unwitting Americans into spreading their content outline.
That's Democratic Senator Mark Warner of Virginia. He's a senior member of the Senate Intelligence Committee, and he had a lot to say about Russian hacking in U.S. affairs in a speech this week in Washington. And he warns the threat continues. We'll have more to come. This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
The CBS News Weekend Roundup after this short break.
Like what you're hearing? Get even more great content from CBS News Radio podcasts. Listen to TV broadcasts like CBS Evening News and Face the Nation on demand.
I'm John Dickerson.
And don't miss The Takeout, a politics, policy, and pop culture podcast from CBS News Chief White House Correspondent Major Garrett.
We have our first member of the Trump administration cabinet at our table, Mick Mulvaney.
Well, you asked the wrong people first.
Subscribe now at Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or Google Play.
This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup. I'm Bill Rakoff. It would not be a 48-hour show if the story didn't have a bunch of twists and turns, and this week's episode will not disappoint you. CBS News correspondent Jim Axelrod joins us here, and boy, I tell you what, just reading the background on this story requires some sit-down and some attention. Tell me a little about it.
So Nuria Los Santos is really
for much of her life, the good girl. Good student, a Clinton Foundation intern as a high schooler. And also, if you believe prosecutors, somebody who might have just been an unwitting accomplice to murder. Noriella had a boyfriend. The boyfriend, she said, was abusive. They were together intensely, broke up. She had a summer romance. The summer romance was not serious, but Noriella ended up with an STD. And when she got back together with her boyfriend, Danny, he then got the STD. He was not happy. He asked Noriella if she would set up a meeting with her summer fling. And Noriella did. The summer fling went out to Long Island. Noriella drove him out there. Then the boyfriend came up out of seemingly nowhere and shot and killed the summer fling, Michael Sinclair. So the story is Noriella, who was then arrested for murder, said, you know what? The only reason I was doing this was because my boyfriend Danny had been beating me, had been abusing me. He told me to do something. I did it. So Noriella Santos, this good girl, this model student, this intern for the Clinton Foundation, Noriella was using the battered spouse defense. Her lawyer, Michael Dowd, actually had pioneered the defense. Noriella was saying, wait a minute, before you try me for murder, understand I only did what I was told to because I was fearing for my life. It's a fascinating question.
It absolutely is. But wait a minute, then there's this boyfriend, the long-term boyfriend, who has a story of his own in all of this.
Danny Greenspan, or Danny Rivera, or Danny Crager, was actually a bit of a chameleon. He had been born to an affluent New York City background. He had grown up and met Noriella Santos. And then Danny Crager decided he wanted to live a little bit more of a street life. In fact, he wanted to be identified as a Spanish-speaking Puerto Rican. And Danny Crager became Daniel Rivera. In fact, he legally changed his name to become Danny Rivera. And Noriella didn't quite know what to make of all of this. After the murder, Danny Van Rivera took one more twist to all of this, moved to Israel, became a Talmudic scholar, and went by Daniel Greenspan. So a chameleon, and actually a deadly chameleon.
So a lot of questions that need to be answered on this week's edition of 48 Hours. The bottom, what's her status now, Santos?
Well, you'll have to tune in on Saturday night to see. Noriella Santos ended up testifying against Danny, and you'll see how that turned out on 48 Hours.
And you can catch it this weekend on your local CBS affiliate. You can also follow 48 Hours on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And podcasts are available as well at radio.com. CBS News correspondent Jim Axelrod, thanks for your time.
Thank you, Bill.
Hundreds of mourners, including President Trump, Vice President Pence, and their families, paid their respects to the Reverend Billy Graham on Friday at his funeral in Charlotte, North Carolina. His son, Reverend Franklin Graham, eulogized the man who preached to everyone from presidents and royalty to the poor and the needy.
He loved his family. He stood by us. He comforted us. He left us an enduring legacy. His uncompromising testimony of God's great love. All of us children came to see the world and our Father in heaven through my father's eyes.
Earlier in the week, I spoke with some people who had come to Washington to see Billy Graham's casket lying in honor in the Capitol Rotunda.
Oh, I'm here to pay my last respects to Papa Billy Graham.
Alexander Adun is a missionary from Nigeria visiting the U.S.
Billy Graham, who has affected my life. When I gave my life to Christ, when I was in high school.
There were similar stories among the people in line outside the Capitol that I spoke with. Debbie Lindsay traveled to Washington from Oklahoma City.
Oh, I was raised on Billy Graham, and my mother was very close to him and always took me to his sermons in Oklahoma City. And I was just mourning his passing and wanted to say my last goodbyes.
I asked her what it was like to attend those crusade rallies back in the late 70s.
Very emotional, very spiritual. He always asked anybody to come down and give their life to God, and that's when I did that.
Attending a rally was something Alexander Adun was never able to do.
So I felt, since I'm in the United States this time, I have to be at the Capitol Hill here to pay my last respect to him.
And that was a sentiment shared by many, as First Street outside the Capitol was completely blocked off with hundreds, if not thousands, of people who stood in line for a chance to pay their respects. Margie Brookbank came to Washington from Eureka Springs, Arkansas, and was overwhelmed with the size of the turnout.
Phenomenal. Look at this crowd and those that are sharing their peace with the rest of the world.
Graham was often quoted as saying that when it was time to go, people would say that he died, but it was far from the truth. He was only changing addresses to heaven. So when asked if she was here to see Graham, Brookbank was ready with her answer.
The Reverend Graham is celebrating in heaven with Jesus. So I'm here because of the impact that the man has made on our country.
Following Friday's funeral, Billy Graham's homemade plywood casket was laid in the ground to the rear of the Graham Library in Charlotte, next to the grave of his wife, Ruth. In addition to the Reverend Graham, we remember several notable personalities who died in recent days, including actress Nanette Fabre, Bill Cosby's oldest daughter, Ensa, and a name you might not know, but a sound you might, Bill Burkett, the lead singer of the 60s vocal group The Vogues. The Vogues achieved top 10 status with hits like 5 O'Clock World, You're the One, My Special Angel, and Turn Around, Look at Me. When he left the group in the late 70s, Burkett took a job in sales, but still performed from time to time as late as last year. Personal note, I grew up across the street from Burkett and his family in suburban Pittsburgh. He was a terrific singer and a better man. Bill Burkett of The Vogues, dead at 75. And that's it for the Weekend Roundup. Thank you, as always, for listening. We want to get your feedback. Please send us your thoughts and your story ideas to weekendroundup at cbsnews.com. You can find the program online at Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, and Spotify. The Weekend Roundup is produced at the CBS News Washington Bureau. Lou Walker is our technical supervisor. Christopher Buckley, our production assistant in New York. Mitchell Fallon is our intern. Have a great week. I'm Bill Rakoff, CBS News.